It is Wednesday afternoon. It's 6 minutes after 2 o'clock, and this is Political Rewind. We're coming to you live from the Midtown Atlanta studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting, and today is the premiere of the new edition of Political Rewind. Starting today and every week, we will be with you, as we have been all along, on Fridays at 3 p.m. for a live show, but now we'll also be on because there is so much in the world of politics to talk about on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. So I hope you will tune in to both editions of Political Rewind starting, as I said, today. With me, my great colleague, Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. He oversees AJC Political Insiders, a daily online blog that really he updates and with his team throughout the day. It's a great way to find out what's going on minute to minute in politics. Welcoming back today, Chip Lake. He's a Republican political consultant who's been working in Georgia in the Southeast for quite a long time now. We also are delighted to have back Dr. Andrew Gillespie from the Political Science Department at Emory University. Thank you so much for coming back, Andra. And again, welcoming back Patricia Murphy. Patricia writes columns for The Daily Beast and for Roll Call. She was based in Washington, but she was lured to Atlanta to be closer to the people in her family, right?
And all the free parking.
All right. So we got so much to talk about today, both in the state legislature as well as on the presidential campaign trail. Jim, let's just very briefly deal with a story that's developed this morning. Governor Nathan Deal gave his State of the State address to a joint session of the legislature. And let's talk just for a minute or two about some of the highlights of what you and I heard.
Well, just mainly the main highlight is if you're a teacher out there, if you're a state employee, you're going to get a 3% raise this
3%.
Year. 3%. That's I think that's the biggest one we've had since for state employees since the Great Recession.
I know you're not the numbers cruncher. That's James Salter's beat. But do you know how much that raise is worth in money?
You know, I don't.
I
really don't.
But
it's a good chunk of change. Now, the teachers, what he's doing, he's giving the money to the school systems for the teachers, and he is threatening the teachers, the school system, saying, "You pass this on to the teachers, or we're going to rethink about how much freedom we're going to give you in the next in years to come." So that was kind of interesting. Education was probably the major theme there, and I think the biggest thing that he did was he gave the legislature permission to study merit-based pay for teachers for a year, which would keep that out of the election cycle and would spare them a great deal of heartburn.
So we knew that the governor had been interested in merit pay. He said he wanted to
And he
push
still
it.
Is. He
well,
still
yeah,
is.
But he also got immediate pushback from David Ralston, Speaker of the House, from other leaders
from
in the
Lindsey
House
Tippins,
and Senate.
From Lindsey Tippins, the Senate Education Chairman.
Chair. So, you know, it makes sense in a way if he wants to put this off. He doesn't need to do that to the legislature in an election.
Well, and the other smart thing he has done is what didn't happen with that Education Reform Commission is they didn't bring classroom teachers into the discussion, not active classroom teachers. You had school superintendents, charter school people, principals there, but not active school classroom teachers.
You know,
and they're going to bring that in there.
Just open this up just a little bit. You know, one of the problems, Chip Lake, I'm sure you know this, is that if you say we're going to have merit pay for teachers, what's the standard? Is it the improvement they show in any one class? You're nodding, Andrew Gillespie.
Well, I mean, when you're thinking about merit pay, first, if you look at public opinion, there's some opposition to it. And I think in Metro Atlanta, a lot of people still remember the CRCT scandal. And so are you incentivizing people to cheat in order to meet sometimes impossible metrics? And then will that actually steer people, depending on how the metrics are defined, to go into easy school districts where you can actually meet those benchmarks on a regular basis? Is that going to actually keep people from going into challenging districts where you have to deal with low expectations? expectations to begin with, and then also the structural issues that tend to impede learning outcomes. So, you know, while on paper merit seems like a good idea, sometimes it's not completely well thought through, and as a result, you end up with cheating scandals and people who are actually good teachers being penalized for the fact that they've had to be teacher, social worker, surrogate parent, and anything else that goes along with that.
Yeah, there were a couple things on this, and Deal did say that the other part of his education package is re-examining the way that we finance the school systems across the state. We use QBE right now, which was established in, what, 85 or so?
QBE for quality basic education.
Exactly, right.
Joe Frank Harris was governor.
Exactly. This time, Deal said for the first time, in the formula of who gets how much money, they want to work the poverty, whether they want to direct more money to students living in poverty, which would be a first.
That's good.
All right. So let's move on, because there are a couple things that Governor Deal did not talk about that really can lead us into the next part of our conversation quickly, and then we'll go beyond this. Jim, he didn't say anything about MARTA expansion into the outer reaches of the Atlanta suburbs. There are a lot of legislators down there who are very interested in seeing if they can make that work this year. If the governor likes the idea, he sure didn't bring it up today.
And he didn't bring it up the day before at the Eggs and Issues breakfast held by the George Chamber. He had a big rollout of a 10-year $10 billion transportation funding package, which was all about roads and bridges and where that money would go. Again, nothing for transit.
All right. By the way, in closing out the governor's portion of this, if you are interested in hearing or watching the governor's State of the State address in its entirety, Georgia Public Broadcasting TV will present it tonight starting at 7 o'clock on our air. And then at the end of that, Senator Vincent Fort will present a short response from Democrats, and then we'll have a conversation after that, kind of breaking down just what happened on lawmakers tonight at 7. Let's move on. Patricia, let me bring you in if I can. The other thing the governor didn't talk about today was any of the religious liberty bills, Josh McCoon's SB 129, or, and we'll talk about this in much more detail in a minute, Greg Kirk's proposal about that will really have an impact on how gay marriage is viewed by perhaps government workers here. No talk from the governor on that. I guess it indicates what a hot political issue that continues to be.
It continues to be an incredibly difficult issue here in Georgia. Arkansas has struggled with this, and we all saw Indiana just throw themselves over the edge of a cliff on this issue last year when Indiana passed a bill, and then they had to quickly rewind and pass what they called a fix to that bill, which other people thought really had watered it down because of the incredible amount of public blowback that they got. And actually, coincidentally, was talking to somebody from the Indiana Chamber earlier today, talking to them about their own experience last year with this religious freedom bill. They said that within 3 hours of the time that their governor, Mike Pence, went on a national show to defend the bill as it was passed, they had 800 million Twitter impressions about Indiana, and about half of those specifically said boycott Indiana,
wow,
talking about the NCAA, the Final Four, any conventions that were held there. And so the focus really became on what the companies there had to say, what they were saying to their own employees, to their own customers. And so Atlanta has a very similar dynamic as Indiana, a large metro area with a rural population, a lot of very different political interests within the state house. And so I think Georgia and other states are looking to what happened in Indiana as they go through with their RFRA policies.
Chip, interesting development on Monday at the Capitol. Let's just set the table on this. Last year, the Senate did in fact pass SB 129, Josh McCoon's religious liberty bill, but it bogged down in the House and was sidelined in the House. It still awaits action in the House. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Wendell Willard, said on Monday, no, it's a Senate bill. We're not going to do anything about it till crossover day, which is day 30.
Usually you don't hear language like that from a House member until well into the session about Senate legislation, but that was early in the process. So piggybacking on what Patricia said, I would not expect anything quickly on any type of religious freedom bill. One of the problems Republicans have had in debating the merits of these different bills that are out there that will be considered here in Georgia is, you know, I've heard a lot of them talk about what is fair, and that's great. We can talk about all that. We can talk about that all day long. But the real question that they need to ask themselves, Patricia had mentioned it, is are the economic consequences of decision making, are they real? And whether that's fair or not, really, at the end of the day, is probably not very relevant. Georgia POL just posted about 20 minutes ago.
Who did?
GeorgiaPOL.com posted that Kevin Tanner from Dawsonville has also introduced a bill today, House Bill 757, that is the, I'm reading it right now, but it's a Pastor Protection Act.
Well, that's David Ralston's measure, which he hopes will sort of be an alternative to what he thinks of as a much more severe bill, which Josh McCune has, right?
So I think ultimately this is going to end up in the courts some way, somehow, because if it's not here, it's someplace else. And so I suspect that there are some people here in Georgia who would rather that another state take the fall on this and then it get adjudicated in the courts and we can all figure out what's going on. And I think based on the issues that are at hand here, it's a question of what exactly are we talking about here? Are we talking about people who wear their faith on their sleeve in the workplace, who are being penalized or discriminated against because people view their views as bigoted, even if there's no evidence of bigoted behavior? Are we talking about government officials who are refusing to act in the interest of someone's civil rights as defined by the courts because they disagree with that point of view and not providing alternatives? So the notion that somebody can refuse to issue a marriage license because they feel they're going to be implicated in their gay wedding and that there are spiritual consequences for that. Like, those are, I think, are the big questions at hand. And so I think we have to define as a country and also as a state, where's the line between religious liberty and civil rights for other people? And what are people comfortable with? And are there alternative options that are available? So if you're in a marriage bureau, if you are uncomfortable issuing that license, is there always somebody on staff who's serving at the same time who can issue that license? Because those same-sex couples do have a legal right to be able to apply for marriage.
So you've set up a really interesting part of the conversation, and that's this. Jim Galloway, as you well know, Josh McCune, from the very beginning, 3 years ago, has repeatedly said this is not a bill aimed at discriminating against gays and lesbians in any way, whether it's in government or the private sector, except when an anti-discrimination amendment was added to the bill in the House, they didn't want it. So that makes you, it does have to make give you pause. But Jim Galloway, as we learned Monday night on Lawmakers, Senator Greg Kirk came in and did the show. He is now, he's a South Georgia boy.
Americus.
He is now proposing a direct on, I think, I want to be careful about my language here. He's going after gay marriage and how government workers especially would deal with it.
Right, and his point would be that the people who still believe in traditional marriage as defined as one man, one woman, need some sort of protection.
Let's listen very quickly to what one of the things he said on our show the other night.
What this bill does is it says that when the Supreme Court made their decision, they not only gave the gay community access to marriage, they changed the definition of marriage. And by changing the definition of marriage, that definition is thousands of years old. It's biblical. And there are millions of Georgians who still hold that the definition of marriage is between a man and a woman.
So this speaks directly to Andrew Gillespie's point, Jim. When pressed on this, he did say if a clerk in a county office does not want to issue a marriage license to a gay couple, that clerk should be protected as long as someone else in the office would issue the license.
Right, right. What he said was he was trying to design the bill so the clerk who refuses would pass the task on to another clerk. If all the other clerks refuse, then the probate judge in each case would be obliged to issue the license personally.
This sounds, Andrew, like just turning backflips, somersaults, everything you can to try to protect people against the notion that gay marriage has now been condoned by the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at national public opinion leading up to the Supreme Court decision last summer, even people who opposed same-sex marriage recognized that it was inevitable. So they saw the tide had already turned before the ruling had been made. And so, you know, there's definitely going to be an adjustment. You know, I don't think that religious conservatives have completely, you know, made things up in their heads about sort of the concerns that they have. But at the same time, if the Supreme Court has said that this is a legal right, then I think people have to come to grips with what their responsibilities are within that context. And I say this as an evangelical. One of the things that's actually really interesting about this is if you're issuing the license, is there a difference between issuing a license and actually performing a marriage? And I think most people would balk at being forced to perform marriages, but providing the paperwork that allows people to go do something someplace else with people who are amenable to helping them, some people may construe that as a different thing. And so, you know, I don't know if that's going to come up in that discussion, but that's actually, you know, that's something that people need to think about.
Just to show you how malleable this issue is on Monday we had Greg Kirk saying he would want to protect clerks of court. We asked him if he wanted to extend that protection to any other state employees, like, you know, revenue agents who process joint tax returns and
state
such.
Tax returns.
Yeah. And he wouldn't give us an answer. But yesterday I happened to meet with David Schaefer. He's the Senate President Pro Tem. And pressed him on that same issue, and he said, look, if you're a public employee, you ought to be doing your job.
Yeah, I think, Patricia, that's what this comes down to, and it's what Andrew alluded to when she said eventually this sort of thing is headed to court. I mean, public employees, can you really protect a public employee from the obligation to perform the function for which they've been hired?
Well, I think, on marriage specifically, I think there's an important distinction between the religious ceremony of marriage and the government function of marriage,
right.
Which the county clerks are involved in.
Right.
But then I think also it's a very slippery slope when you're getting into, what if one person's religion tells them one thing and somebody else's religion tells them the exact opposite? When you're having government legislation wrapped around or woven into people's religious beliefs, I think you are absolutely heading toward the court, because we also all know that if somebody says, well, this is my belief because I'm a Muslim, there are going to be a lot of people who come forward and say, well, that is not a valid reason for you to be able to be protected by the government. So I think that, you know, which religion, which opinion, whose opinion, once you have the government having different tiers of what is protected, which is better or worse, it's a very dangerous area, but I do think that it will ultimately go to the courts to do the parameters.
Real quick, Bill, an underlying thematic in all of these discussions about all these bills that are out there with respect to religious liberty is timing. You know, timing is everything in legislating. It's everything in politics. I've heard Senator McCoon just recently, you know, talk about the discussion with respect to the Super Bowl and how this might hurt Georgia's bid to host a Super Bowl. And, you know, at the end of the day, he cites 7 out of the last 10 states that have hosted Super Bowls have had RFRA-type bills. But those bills were passed in a different era than we live in today. And Indiana was a game changer. It was a big game changer. And so, you know, I think when this debate is over with, I think we will look back and we will see what states did before Indiana and after Indiana.
And again, this year, Indiana is taking up the issue as we are taking it up.
You know,
right now,
last night, our colleague Todd Rehm, I heard him make an interesting comment. We were invited to do kind of a live version of Political Rewind in front of the Fulton County Republican Chair's Council. It was kind of a fun session, and we were glad they invited us. And Todd had an interesting comment that we haven't heard on this show, but I throw it out to all of you. He said, you know what? He said, and you referred to the rural and urban Georgia and the divide there. Todd said, you know, people outside of Metro Atlanta are tired of hearing the argument that, oh, we won't get a Super Bowl if we pass a religious liberty bill, or as the AJC poll revealed this past week, even if that bill does discriminate against gays and lesbians, there's a substantial number of people who say they'd support it. But he says, so out in rural Georgia or the other parts, they don't care about whether people come to the Super Bowl here. They have moral values that they want this legislature to take up.
So, I mean, and I think that we have to have a serious conversation about that. But we are also in an era where I think people have to be aware and cognizant of the fact that there are a lot of people who disagree. And that there are a lot of people who have very, very different values from them. And so I think people are worried that their compromise is going to end up sort of affecting their witness and affecting their standing with God. But there's also sort of this notion of being able to respectfully agree to disagree.
Right.
And I think the national discussion has not figured out a way to agree to disagree, because you're either a bigot or, you know, you're If you disagree with the other side, or you know, you're stupid, or you're completely immoral. But I think people are going to have to figure out where that happy medium is, so that people can say, I disagree with that, but you have a legal right to do that, and that the government has, you know, is legally obligated to accommodate that.
Well, we're talking about the rural-urban divide here. One of the more interesting facts that came out during this debate last year was the census data that showed where same-sex couples live in Georgia. Top two counties were Fulton and DeKalb, of course. You know what was number three? Fannin County.
Really?
Interesting.
The House Speaker David Ralston's.
Per capita or total?
Per capita.
Wow.
But although to Chip's point about, you know, whether it's fair and whether it's right and whether it's real, in rural Georgia, would you like BMW to consider coming to your area? Would you like to have more economic development? I mean, it's not just what's there now, but what could be there in the future. And there are multinational companies that have no interest in controversy, whether it's right or wrong. They're like, you know what? We'll go to South Carolina. We'll talk to you later.
So, economic interests are at stake outside of Metro Atlanta in many cases. All right. So let's finish off with the legislative session by just pointing out something else interesting that happened this week. We all know, and Chip Lake is one of them, there is an army of lobbyists down at the Capitol. What are there, about 580 of you down there, Chip, lobbying?
I am not a lobbyist, but there are people lobbying for that.
Government affairs specialists.
Indeed.
Who want to see casino gambling working for MGM Grand, for Sheldon Adelson, for who knows who out there. And so the legislation to establish casinos in Georgia had two components. Mm-hmm. One, a constitutional amendment needed to be approved by the legislature, 2/3 vote, to get it on the ballot in November of this year. Georgia voters make the choice, right? The other was enabling legislation, simply sets the rules for how casinos would operate, including what the tax structure and the tax rate would be. Well, this week, a slight setback, Chip, and I'll let you comment on this first. Slight setback, there was a decision to take this enabling legislation off the table to just work for the constitutional amendment.
Right.
Now, enabling legislation could be complicated by factors like the state trying to get the best deal they can in terms of the tax structure. Nevertheless, this means that if you want casinos in Georgia, you're going to have to wait at least another year, because that won't come back until next session.
No, I read the same story, and I would say to everybody that's kind of watching what's going to happen down in the legislature with this particular issue is, much like a lot of legislation that goes through the legislature, it's a process bill. The legislature's working their process. I don't view it particularly as a bad sign. I mean, look, we've got to get this right. This is a big deal. We've got to get this right. So if we take some time to get it right, I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing. I mean, there was a poll that came out that the AJC conducted a couple of days before that story came out, showed that just under 70% of people favor casino gambling in Georgia, and that question didn't have any tie at all to the Hope Scholarship. And so I think, you know, all legislation goes through peaks and valleys. It's a long session. It's a long process. This is going to happen as well. And the fact of the matter is, we've got millions and millions of dollars that Georgians are spending out of state, and we believe we need to keep those dollars here and rake those tax revenues in order to sustain the Hope Scholarship for years to come.
Yeah, this is really a very strategic move here. In order to get a constitutional amendment on the ballot in November, you have to have the approval of 2/3 of each chamber. Mm-hmm. That means you can't tolerate any defections from your coalition. And if you are there arguing about whether you're going to have five casinos here or 10 casinos there, or if your tax rate is going to be 25% or 40%, then you start to fracture that coalition. And I think that's what the true thinking is.
Well, there's another matter here, I think, Patricia. A constitutional amendment, if approved by both the House and the Senate, takes Governor Deal out of the picture. He does not get to veto legislation asking for a constitutional amendment, and he's been opposed to casinos. So in some ways, doing this first neutralizes a guy who's against you, perhaps.
And neutralizes it. It certainly makes it a lot easier for him also.
But right.
Some sort of step away from the matter and remain friends with everyone on both sides. And I've been amazed at how broad this coalition is, because there are a lot of different reasons for people to want to have this bill. So I think probably he might have been very happy to see that development.
But I will tell you here that if you're going to have, this has to be a bipartisan coalition. You have to have Democrats, you have to have Republicans. I was talking to Steve Henson, who heads up the Senate Democrats, and I asked him what Republican has been reaching out to him, and he said he hadn't heard from any. He has heard plenty from the casino people, but he hasn't heard from the ranking person in the Senate or the House who might be able to put a deal. Because Democrats, if they join this coalition, they want something out of it. They want a price. Who can guarantee that they're going to be rewarded for their participation?
So we'll watch it unfold. Andra, you declared a couple minutes ago that you're evangelical. So how do you see the evangelical community in Georgia as this fight continues? I mean, back in 1991, evangelicals lined up dead set against Zell Miller trying to get lottery passed. And I assume we're going to see an organized effort against casinos, too, from the religious community.
So I expect that there will be some who have moral opposition to it. Not all evangelicals are against gambling, but there will be a contingent of people who will, you know, bring up problem gambling. And then there will also be an academic contingent that might point out that the intended sort of economic development boon that people expect from gambling might not materialize as well. So that there may be an economic argument to suggest that you might focus on other avenues of economic development as opposed to this one.
Okay.
You know, especially in certain rural parts, you know, of the state. So if you put something in a place that's not particularly well populated, are people going to make that a destination spot? And in particular, is there the type of skilled labor base in that area that's actually going to benefit the people who live there?
So this is going to go on, right, Chip Lake, all session. We're going to have plenty of opportunities to argue about this. Go ahead.
One more final thing, and then I'll turn it back over to you, Bill. It's important to note, though, legislators will not be voting on whether to allow gaming in Georgia. They will be voting on whether or not they want to let the voters say if they want to allow gaming in Georgia. And then if the voters do say they want gaming in Georgia, then each of the regions that are set up in Representative Stevens' bill would then have an opportunity to vote too.
Jim Galloway, I hear a talking point that's being passed around among all the government affairs specialists like Chip. We are going to give the people of Georgia an opportunity to decide for themselves. It happens to be true.
It's very true.
But it's also a smart way to frame the argument.
Well, this is the way has been paved by Sunday beer sales. I mean, that's the model that's being worked here.
Yeah. All right. Look, so lots happening at the legislature, but eclipsed only by what's going on in the presidential race. Getting more exciting by the minute, isn't it, Patricia?
I literally wake up every day. I'm like, what's going to happen today?
All right. So let's take a quick break, get that out of the way, and come back. Let's start talking presidential politics. This is Political Rewind. It's Wednesday at 2:33 in the afternoon.
You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network. Thank you for joining us. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, contributing to the cultural climate, education, and healthcare services available in Atlanta.
Support for GPB comes from our generous members and the Southern Environmental Law Center, protecting healthy air, clean water, and special places throughout the South, from the mountains to the coast. Information at southernenvironment.org.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Patricia Murphy of Roll Call and Daily Beast is here. Dr. Andra Gillespie, who is at Emory University in the Political Science Department. Chip Lake, Republican consultant. And the AJC's Jim Galloway. Okay, I have a confession. I've got to get off my chest. Last Friday on this show, I said, well, you know, we're going to cover this. We'll talk a lot about the Republican contest, but as long as Hillary appears to be in good shape in Iowa and New Hampshire, we're not going to do much with the Democratic contest. Well, Andra, things have changed. We see polling now that shows Bernie Sanders on the rise in Iowa. He's already been out front, and he's moving even further out front in New Hampshire, suddenly this is a real contest.
And I think this is a good thing for politics in general and for Democratic Party politics in particular. I mean, there doesn't need to be a coronation of one candidate over the other. So you kind of need to make your paces and strengthen yourself by the challenge of this particular race. So, you know, Hillary Clinton has always been a bit of a problematic candidate. So she's somebody who for the most of her public life has enjoyed net unfavorable ratings. And so, you know, she, you know, usually becomes net positive for a brief period of time as she's getting ready to run for an office. But then she also has, you know, the baggage of what she did in the Obama administration and, you know, the things that happened in her husband's administration that could come back to haunt her if Republicans can harness a message that could actually be effective. You know, Sanders is creating this populist message that's really appealing to younger voters and newer voters, and there seems to be a certain level of excitement about him. I think what Clinton is hoping for is that even if she loses Iowa and New Hampshire, that when they come to the South, where it's going to be ideologically more conservative even amongst Democrats and where she would have higher name recognition and where she represents a more conservative wing of the party, which might attract more African Americans than Bernie Sanders. And I should be very, very clear. Typically speaking, African Americans are ideologically usually more liberal than your average Democrat. But there are differences between black progressivism versus the type of white progressivism that Bernie Sanders represents. And he's done a lot to actually try to overcome that in the last few months. But it's a question of, will that resonate in Georgia? Will that resonate in Alabama? And so Clinton hopes that she beats him here so that she can then stop the momentum that Sanders may gain in Iowa and New Hampshire.
So there's a lot to unpack in what you just said, and we're going to do that. But first, let's listen to how the rhetoric is heated up out there on the campaign trail. First of all, let's listen to just a brief soundbite from Bernie Sanders this week.
If people are concerned about electability, and Democrats should be very concerned, because we certainly do not want to see some right-wing extremist in the White House, I think Bernie Sanders is the candidate.
So he continues his message. He does at another point in that same speech that he gave, or same interview, rather, that he gave, talk about how all of a sudden Hillary Clinton's no longer talking about what a nice guy Bernie Sanders is. And here's how Hillary is now going after him, specifically on the issue of his position on guns as a senator from Vermont.
Do we give the gun lobby, the manufacturers and the sellers, absolute immunity from any liability or accountability? President Obama and I were both in the Senate, and we voted no. Senator Sanders voted yes.
So Patricia, Andrew says, you know, Hillary Clinton has always had some trouble reaching voters, getting them to warm up to her. What's going on here?
You know, I think it's important to remember, and we all do, that Hillary Clinton lost her last race for president. She lost in Iowa. She had a really tough time in a number of states and eventually got both out-campaigned and out-thought in that whole process. So she's coming off of doing this wrong one time. And I don't see that many changes, especially in her style. I don't see a lot of changes from the old Hillary Clinton. So I think people turn on their TVs, they're like, ugh, that's who I voted against last time. Why are you back? I just think substantively, she's very similar to the way she was before. And then it's also a different time. We're 8 years later. Income inequality in the country has gotten worse in Democrats' minds. A populist message from somebody like Bernie Sanders, who is so terrific on the stump. I mean, to see, I was so shocked when I saw him campaign. He's so good at it. You wouldn't expect it. He's clear, he's direct, he's consistent, and he believes it. And I think those are all areas where Hillary Clinton suffers. However, I could see her losing Iowa again and New Hampshire. However, when she comes to the South, South Carolina, she has a 50% advantage over Bernie Sanders. People don't particularly know him, and once they hear him, they don't. Yeah, I think he just doesn't have a relationship down here.
Well, when
you get to the March 1st primary, I think it's a buzzsaw for him.
So before we get to that, because we do want to talk about how this is going to work in the South, Chip, you're a political consultant. It strikes me there are some ways in which Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush have a similar problem that they face out on the campaign. And that is, people are talking about how they communicate, how they campaign, their uncomfortable style as they talk. they're not talking about, in many cases, what the issues are. Patricia just did it herself, which is perfectly fine. When you've got a candidate who people are saying, well, where's the authenticity there? Joe Biden, let's listen to what Joe Biden said in an interview. It'll come up a little later in this soundbite, but you'll hear it.
There used to be a basic bargain. If you contributed to the profitability of an enterprise, you got to share in the profit. That's been broken. Productivity's up. Wages are stagnant.
But Hillary's talking about that as
well. It's relatively new for Hillary to talk about that. Hillary's focus has been on other things up to now, and that's been Bernie's. No one questions Bernie's authenticity on those issues.
And they question hers, you think?
Well, I think they question everybody's who hasn't been talking about it all along.
So I think that was the Savannah Guthrie interview on the Today Show. But look, there's what I'm talking about. Yeah. It's about style right now. And even Joe Biden, you know, is going against Hillary a little there.
He just can't help himself. I mean, you can just hear a little bit of buyer's remorse. I think there's a lot of buyer's remorse with a lot of Democrats out there that they didn't field a stronger candidate against Hillary. I think it would have made her a better candidate. I mean, let's face it. Bernie Sanders is not a very strong candidate. I mean, if that's the best that they can have from an alternative against Hillary Clinton, then it would make sense that there are a lot of Democrats that have concerns with the fact that we are this close to the Iowa caucuses and New Hampshire primaries.
Why isn't he a strong candidate?
We could talk for a while. I don't think he is anybody that any Democrat really believes has a chance at winning a general election.
If I can interrupt, he's still learning how to speak African American.
He's got
a dynamite spokesman for him in Killer Mike. I mean, the rapper, and I'm serious. The guy is good.
Hey, if Killer Mike, if you're listening to our show, because I know you love politics, get in here. We want you to talk
about
it.
Oh, absolutely.
I don't think it's just that. I mean, I think that's important when you're dealing with the base of the Democratic Party to make sure that they're enthused and want to come out and support you. But I think Bernie Sanders' bigger problem is that Democratic Socialist thing that could potentially turn people off. And especially in a general election scenario when you're trying to appeal to that middle voter who might not have a whole lot of information and doesn't necessarily have the same type of coherent worldview that, extreme conservatives and extreme liberals have, like that might be the type of thing that could turn off a median voter. So I think the question kind of becomes, who do the Republicans nominate? Like if it's Bernie Sanders versus Donald Trump, I don't know, how much that matters. But if one of the establishment Republican candidates win and it's Bernie Sanders, then that socialist moniker is a bit of a liability.
Okay, so let's talk about the turn south. Patricia's already mentioned it. The South, you say that Hillary maybe could lose Iowa, could lose New Hampshire, but the South will, and Georgia specifically, will bring her back. But Do we all agree that that's right, that Sanders doesn't have much chance to get a base here that will turn out for him?
I think what you have to remember is Hillary Clinton isn't just Hillary Clinton.
She's Bill Clinton.
She is Bill Clinton too.
Right.
And since what, the early 90s, the Clintons have been working the South. They have a network here.
Yeah, but remember, Bill Clinton won Georgia in 1992, but he lost it against
right. But we're only talking about the we're talking about the primary.
Okay,
here.
You're right. I apologize.
We're talking about
you're
the
right.
primary here.
You're right.
And actually, South Carolina, as far as the Clintons are concerned, is their weak state because of Bill Clinton's performance there in 2008. So they only get stronger as you shift.
I spoke with a number of African American voters in South Carolina. It was far more important to them that Hillary Clinton is Barack Obama's Secretary of State than she is Bill Clinton's wife, because that to them says she was his most important advisor. He brought her into the fold immediately, and he relied on her advice, and he trusted her to do that very important job for him. So the Barack Obama approval of her is extremely important to Black voters that I spoke with.
Plus, it's very important to Iowa and New Hampshire voters that they're not told who to vote for by the national polls. And so I'm not surprised it's tightening a little bit. Do I think it's realistic that Bernie Sanders could win both of those states? I don't know. Maybe. But, I still think Hillary Clinton will be the nominee. The last person to lose, last Democrat to lose Iowa and New Hampshire and go on to be the nominee was Bill Clinton in 1992. I think he lost Iowa to Tom Harkin, and he lost New Hampshire to Paul Tsongas.
Came in third.
Yeah, so it's I think it'll happen, but Iowa and New Hampshire voters, they like to flex their muscle a little bit and be a little bit and stand out a little bit.
So you know what's funny about all this, Andra, is that we in the media, we like to be troublemakers. So as Hillary fades a little bit in Iowa, or as Sanders comes on strong and remains strong in New Hampshire, we're loving this idea that, well, maybe now's a chance for Joe Biden again. You know, in the same way we're talking about brokered convention on the Republican side, we're not, well, maybe there's an opportunity for Biden to step in. John Kerry. Hey, what about Al Gore? We should bring him back. Is that all just wishful thinking on a media that can't get enough of entertaining political stories?
I think it is a lot of wishful thinking. I mean, at least as far as the primary is concerned, so putting the broker convention aside, you know, there is this problem of filing deadlines and other types of things. So, you know, I'm sure Joe Biden is probably kicking himself at this point for not having gotten into the race, but I think he's just going to have to look at that as a regret.
All right. With that, we got a lot of Republican presidential politics to talk about as well, but let's get our second breakout out of the way and come back, talk Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and all the rest of those Republicans.
On the next Fresh Air, Elizabeth Strout, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning collection of stories Olive Kitteridge, which was adapted into an HBO miniseries. Strout's new novel, My Name is Lucy Barton, was described in the New York Times Sunday Book Review as articulating the Gordian knot of family, binding together fear and misery, solace and love. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
It's 2:47 on Wednesday afternoon. You're listening to the new Wednesday edition of Political Rewind. Just a reminder, we are now going to be with you every Wednesday and Friday. Wednesday at 2, we continue on Fridays in our usual 3 p.m. time slot. Jim Galloway is here, Chip Lake, Andrew Gillespie, and Patricia Murphy around the table today. So let me lead into the Republican presidential race by talking about another Democrat, President Obama. And let me get your reaction to a statement that I think it makes sense. Last night in his State of the Union address, President Obama he gambled in the way he talked that what the American people want is an optimistic vision of the best of who we are and can be. And in a way, he was setting up the race for Democrats to adopt that same philosophy, as opposed to what he talked about as the divisive, fear-mongering side of the Republican contest. Is that basically correct?
I would agree with that largely. I think the place where I was most surprised about his optimism was when he was talking about ISIS. And so just the way that he presented it, and as I reflect on it, it was actually interesting how he did it. There were times I thought he was a little cocksure. But in doing it that way, it's going to be really hard for a Republican to try to counter that. Because what are you going to say, that we don't have the best military in the world, when there's plenty of evidence to suggest that that is, in fact, the case? So, you know, I think the risk of his framing of that issue is that if we get a lone wolf terrorist attack anytime soon, people are going to point back to this speech and say he was asleep at the wheel and probably a little too confident.
Yeah, you know, Patricia, he did this cocksure thing that you're talking about. I did think it's worth pointing out this line in which he said, if you think we're soft on terrorism, ask Osama bin Laden. It was a surprising remark, I thought, to hear from a president of the United States.
That was a 2012 one.
I think it revealed his frustration. People say he's soft on terrorism, like, what about Osama bin Laden? I got bin Laden. What I was most surprised about was how much of his time he used in his final State of the Union to take swipes at the Republican contenders and to talk about, you know, talking about people carpet bombing civilians.
Went after Ted Cruz on that.
Specifically Ted Cruz. Religious tests in America are un-American, specifically against Donald Trump. And I think it was his way of reminding people and maybe even living up to his own promises to be a different kind of candidate and a different kind of president, to do an overlay of the current campaign and say, this is not who we are as Americans.
All right, so Chip Lake, that sets us up. for what is becoming a fascinating contest in Iowa, especially Ted Cruz, Donald Trump. Cruz is still a little bit ahead, but Trump seems to be have some momentum moving up on him. But the intensity of the argument between them is certainly growing, isn't it?
It definitely is, and I'm just happy that after 8 or 9 months of campaigning that it looks like we're finally on the precipice of having people vote.
Yeah.
And when that happens, you're going to see the dynamic change a lot. And, you know, Bill, you've spent a lot of time in Iowa for these contests, these presidential preference contests. Iowa's a tough state to poll because it's a caucus state, obviously. It's not a traditional state where you have 12 hours to vote on. And so a lot of the support that Donald Trump seems to be getting in these surveys are from people who, at least half of the support in the last survey that I saw, are from people who have never been to a caucus before. Now, historically in the past, we would say, well, we're not going to have half of the people that vote in the Iowa caucuses be new voters. But I wouldn't take that for granted.
I don't know how you can with what Trump has been able to accomplish in this race so far. Right.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm not so sure about is how well organized he is in Iowa. And I think that that is going to be the difference between winning or losing for him or performing or underperforming.
You're right. That has been the conventional wisdom. But the reports coming out of Iowa from people like Washington Post reporters and others say that he has a much better ground game there than the rest of us out here away from Iowa realize. So we'll see if that's true or not.
But I've also seen similar reports on NBC, for instance, that suggest that Ted Cruz has a very well-organized ground
really well
game
organized.
In Iowa.
So Jim Galloway, we laughed about it a week ago, but it increasingly is becoming an actual issue. Is Ted Cruz ineligible to be president because he was born of a U.S. citizen in Canada? And you know what? Even if that's absurd, people are talking about that. And in a close contest, that sort of thing has consequences, yes?
John McCain won't stop talking about it. We had a law professor in the Washington Post. Help me with her name. Do you recall her name?
I'd actually never heard of her before. I was surprised.
Out of Delaware, make the case that, no, there is substance to this. That we should be looking closely at Ted Cruz.
And even if there's not, it hurts, doesn't it?
It hurts. I actually was talking to an Iowa conservative today who said, well, I'll support Ted Cruz if he's eligible.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm like, what are you
There you
talking?
Go.
I mean, Donald Trump is brilliant at these types of things. And he didn't have a 10-year reality show that had 28 million viewers for nothing. He knows how to communicate and he knows how to get under people's skin. And he is just planting enough of a seed in the doubt in some people's minds that you can see it just shading a vote or two.
Here's how Cruz responded to that this week.
The American people are looking for who's ready to be commander-in-chief, who's got the experience, who's got the judgment, the seriousness of purpose, the clarity of vision, the strength of resolve to keep this country safe and defeat our enemies. And in my view, any candidates, or for that matter, folks in the press who want to go down rabbit trails and circus sideshows are distracting from the real issues the American people are focused on.
Ted Cruz saying that it's basically a silly chase to go after whether he's eligible to be president.
I got a question. If you're a Democrat, can you die of Schadenfreude?
Let's find out today.
Every time Maureen Dowd uses that word in one of her columns, which she does frequently, I always have to go back to the dictionary to remind myself what it means.
Joy in somebody else's
right.
despair.
I get it.
You know, but one of the things that I wish Cruz and those who are trying to defend him on this issue would call out is that this is dog whistle politics and that, you know, people weren't talking about this vociferously when it was John McCain's eligibility that we were talking about, even though he was actually born on a military base, which is technically U.S. soil at the time. But this has only been levied against candidates of color. And so regardless of what I think about them ideologically or from a partisan standpoint, it's like, yeah, like this comes off a little racist to me.
Really?
And
interesting.
And that if we were talking about somebody who, if this had been Elizabeth Taylor, for instance, running, you know, who was born in London of American parents, nobody questions her, you know, U.S. citizenship, that we wouldn't have had this type of discussion. And it would be really nice if Ted Cruz would call a spade and then see whether or not that actually has.
You said because he's of Hispanic background.
Right. And it's Cuban father. Like, yeah, if it was his English father, nobody would care.
Chip, you want to jump
That's
in?
That's fascinating. I can't believe Donald Trump would make such an assertion. I come at this from a completely different, and all my Republican colleagues think I'm crazy with it, but I actually I don't believe Donald Trump wants to be president, Bill. I believe he got into this, and I'll call it an experiment because I still think it's in the experimentation stage. I think he got into this race thinking that he was going to say what he has said and that it wouldn't be politically correct and it wouldn't succeed and he wouldn't be doing well in the polls. And all of a sudden, the dog caught the car, and I don't know that he has an exit strategy. I believe one of the reasons he said what he said about banning Muslims from coming into this country, I think he's trying to find a way. He doesn't want to govern. I think he's smart enough to know, as brilliant as he is as a marketing guy, I think he realizes he doesn't want to govern. And so if he does lose Iowa, it's going to be a very interesting
thing. I would just like to raise a question mark on that theory. I've seen him speak many times. That guy wants to be president.
Yeah, I think his exit strategy is leaving the reviewing stand at the inauguration to walk
in
the front door of the White
House. I think he's too smart.
There was a point in September where he started to believe that he will be the president. Yeah. And so I think he is ready to roll and has,
I think he goes to bed at night going, how stupid are
these people?
All right,
we're almost out of time. I want to do real quick. Tomorrow night, Republican debate. On Friday's political rewind, we'll reassess it. But who stand among the field of more traditional candidates, who's going to gain most, do you imagine, tomorrow night?
Chris Christie has big potential right here. He's the only candidate who is ascendant that we see. I think Rubio has something to prove, and I think that Jeb Bush, this is his very last chance to do anything at all.
You want to weigh in?
Well, you know what? I mean, I don't know if I disagree with that. I do want to wait to see what John Kasich does. So he's the mainstream Republican who's kind of like the grown-up and not Jeb Bush.
Yeah. You know, Chip Blake, it's interesting that Rand Paul has decided not to participate at all. Because as I watch Rand Paul lately, he's kind of been like the Lindsey Graham. He's saying really interesting, smart things out there, but he's got no traction and nobody much cares.
Saying interesting, smart things is a very bad thing to do. It doesn't seem to get you a whole lot of traction. So it might be part of this problem.
Finally, we're not going to have time to play your soundbite, but Jim, Nikki Haley got up last night, gave the Republican response, and she called out the conservatives in the Republican Party because they're not supporting some form of pathway for immigrants to be able to stay here. Very interesting.
We talked about Obama going after Trump and Cruz, but Nikki Haley did too.
I'm wondering if she's thinking that the mainstream establishment will eventually win, and because she is acceptable to the Tea Party, that she actually helps to balance out that ticket in many ways.
I think the Tea Party may not be on board with Nikki Haley anymore.
No,
but
probably
I do think
not.
She's very attractive.
Well, and Ann Coulter last night tweeted out some really nasty stuff about her. But the fact of the matter is, I was fascinated that she took that stand. Because of so many conservatives in her own party that don't agree with what she had to say. Wow. All right, look, I'm sorry to break this off, but we are completely out of time. Patricia Murphy, Andrew Gillespie, Jim Galloway, always a pleasure to have you. Chip Blake, thank you for being here. Two quick notes. We are back on the air Friday afternoon, live at 3 o'clock. We'll look at the Republican debate. This weekend on Two Way Street, John Meacham talks about his biography of George Herbert Walker Bush, and he talks about the real personal George Bush. It's really an interesting conversation, so I hope you'll join us for that too. Thank you to Jonathan Reedy, our producer, Daryl Welch, best researcher and booker in town. Thank you as well. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll see you all again on Friday afternoon at 3:00.